Hi, this is Paul. We're going to continue on in the Jordan Peterson Exodus seminar. But before we do that, I want to talk about, in some ways, the seminar itself. There's a very interesting article written in Current Magazine. I think that's mostly a Canadian magazine. And the article is a revised version of a plenary lecture given at Kuiper Conference on Public Theology at Redeemer University in Ontario earlier this year. Now, those of you who don't know, Redeemer University is sort of the Canadian counterpart to, let's say, what Calvin and Dort are in the United States and the Christian Reformed Church. A number of Canadians, a lot of Christian Reformed Canadians were going to Grand Rapids and going to Iowa, which was difficult and costly and had to go cross-border. So a number of years ago, they established their own university, and that's Redeemer. And this article was really very interesting. And one of the very interesting things was it got a Jordan Peterson mention. Well, let me talk about the article first before I get to the Jordan Peterson mention. The article begins this way. I begin with an epigram from an unusual sort of public theologian, the American poet Walt Whitman. Great poets, Whitman said, require great audiences. Among Americans interested in public theology, the question has often been asked, where is the Reinhold Niebuhr of this generation? It's a super interesting choice, and a very valid one, because Reinhold Niebuhr was, in the middle of the 20th century, the mainline public theologian. To a degree, Billy Graham was too, but Graham was evangelical, and you can dig into Aaron Wren and figure out sort of the nuances beneath that. Among Reformed Christians, the question shifts with a nod to songwriter Paul Simon. Where have you gone, Abraham Kuyper? Why are there no Abraham Kuypers or Reinhold Niebuhrs today? In line with Whitman, I submit that the answer is that there is no more Kuyperian audience today. It does a nice job of sort of giving a little overview for people who don't know who Abraham Kuyper was. He became Prime Minister of the Netherlands. He established the Reformed Churches of the Netherlands, which upon its foundation became the second largest Calvinist denomination in the country behind the state-supported Dutch Reformed Church. In addition, he founded the Free University of Amsterdam, the Anti-Revolutionary Party, and a newspaper. And so he left his mark on that country. And then he goes on to basically say, he pays some attention looking at the lower 48, but most of his attention is to Canada. Talks about George Grant, who I didn't know anything about. And then eventually mentions Jordan Peterson. And I was really happy with that mention because I think in many ways, even though Jordan Peterson really isn't a Reinhold Niebuhr, he's by no means that sort of role, but the times are enormously different too. And with the Exodus seminar, I actually don't think, even whether you agree or disagree with Jordan Peterson, and he says some positive and negative things about Jordan in the article, I think in many ways the Exodus seminar is one of the more remarkable pieces of public theology going on in the culture. Jordan has pretty much single-handedly brought far more people to consider the Bible, ponder the Bible, bring greater appreciation for the role of the Bible in the culture than, you know, some might argue that. Was Tim Keller a public theologian? Yeah. You know, he would make the New York Times, he would make the Atlantic, but even for, now we're going to get into the whole winsome thing. For as much as I love Tim Kuyper, and I really do, Jordan Peterson changed, I think, Jordan Peterson probably brought more people into the church than Tim Keller. So, And part of this is through things like this Exodus seminar. These things are being watched by millions of people. And when Jordan does sort of his solo act on the Pentateuch, well, it's going to continue. Jordan has, in many ways, brought the Bible to the consciousness of not only Canada and the United States, but also Great Britain, Australia, the Netherlands, and other places in the world. And so, yeah, he's, in my mind, probably the most preeminent public theologian we have. He's done more than, I think he's pretty much done more than just about anybody else. So you can argue that in the comment section. Let's get to the plague of water to blood. Peterson opens with Iliada, which is an interesting, isn't it all surprising for Peterson because he's a big fan, of course. And he makes the comment that as a human ruler, now, again, because I am limited to 10 minutes, I'm limited by Daily Wire to 10 minutes from each episode, I'm sort of going through and seeing how much of the episode I can do without actually playing any video. And that way, these comments will be safe on YouTube. I won't have to take them down, let's say, or I won't get copyright strikes. So he opens with Iliada and says, as a human ruler becomes more corrupt, their ability to govern nature fails. And I thought that's a deeply important point, and it really reaches back. At the end of this video, I'm going to talk about a conversation between Preston Sprinkle and Tim Mackey, where Mackey makes the point that in many ways, what you see is the main themes are brought out in Genesis 1 and 2, and they just sort of continue to be woven through the rest of the story. But this point about dominion, that our right role in creation, you shall have dominion over the creation, and we are to rule in a way, and you can listen to Jonathan Peugeot talk about what leadership should be. We should rule in a way that makes everything under us flourish. And this is a powerful point, because basically when there is corruption and when humans fail to rule well, nature bites back. And he used the example of Katrina, the flood in New Orleans, and corruption with respect to the flood control programs there. Now, I don't know how hard you want to push against this, because Red State Louisiana, legacy of corruption, super blue state California, a little fastidious with its flood control. Sacramento and New Orleans were sort of vying for top spot of places most vulnerable for flooding. Now, our reservoirs are full this year, so we'll see if we get whacked, if we get another wet winter. Now, as I sort of report these ideas, I do, at least in my own opinion, try to sharpen them up a little bit, because of course, all these opinions are sort of given off the cuff. And after thinking about them a little bit, well, you know, I'm sure if you were writing them down, and the process of writing actually usually sort of sharpens these kinds of things, I hope at least I'm improving them. James Orr makes the point that the Nile is Egypt, and that's very true. The Nile is why Egypt was a perennial empire going way, way back. And the Egyptians very much understood this. Dennis Prager makes the point that, well, this sort of points back to the drowning of the Hebrew boys in the Nile. And that idea, and of course I add my own ideas as I comment on, like I do if I sort of run through and make my comments. In fact, I probably get more ideas doing it this way. It's interesting, this mode of killing that the Egyptians chose. I made the point in the last video with respect to the Passover, that this Passover lamb, the way it's described in chapter 12, very much looks like an offering that is given, like a sacrifice, like a whole burnt offering. Well, in many ways, throwing little boys into the river to drown is sort of a sacrifice given to the river god, that the river god would take the boys and consume the boys. And, you know, that's sort of a deep symbol. Our language, we talk that way about, you know, the sea consuming. Well, the river would consume. And so then my comment on this, to sort of paraphrase Prager a little bit, is that Pharaoh has already made the river a river of blood. But again, figuratively, not physically. And now this is coming to pass symbolically. And there's very much a sense in which a lot of these plagues, and we touched on this in the last video, a lot of these plagues are in a sense the Lord saying, is this what you want? I will give it to you so hard, you'll beg me to stop. And that's very much at work here. Oh, you want to worship the Nile? Well, let's give it blood. Greg Hurwitz mentions that what he remembered from Jesuit high school, something that is not uncommonly known. Oz Guinness will make the point in many other places that a lot of the pieces that are addressed are God is taking on the gods of Egypt. Now, a land of Egypt and a culture of Egypt, these polytheistic cultures, in fact, have so many gods. Augustine sort of poked fun at them in his book, The City of God, that, you know, if you're going to take things apart, you're just going to be dismantling gods because they're just replete and filled with gods all over the place. And again, Orr reminds that the Nile is a god. And then Jonathan starts a section which sort of picks up on something that Peterson had said earlier about the use of the rod. Peterson had said earlier that the rod sort of connects heaven and earth. The rod, in some ways, is this chaos and order symbol. The rod is a symbol of power. It's a symbol of authority. And then Jonathan says, of course, because he's an icon carver, early images of Christ show him doing miracles with a rod, which, of course, isn't really present at all in the Gospels themselves in description. But that's a very interesting thing. It's an externalization of authority. Now, one of the most commonly quoted psalms in the New Testament is Psalm 110. The Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. Now, this is a rather surprising psalm to look at when you think about the way that Jesus conquered. But they very much saw Jesus as a conqueror, and so the rod is very much not far from this. Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. The Lord will extend your mighty scepter from Zion, saying, rule in the midst of your enemies. Your troops will be willing on your day of battle, arrayed in holy splendor. Your young men will come to you like dew from the morning's womb. The Lord has shown and will not change his mind. You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. The Lord is at your right hand. He will crush kings on the day of his wrath. He will judge the nations, heaping up the dead and crushing the rulers of the whole earth. He will drink from a brook along the way, so he will lift his head high. But this verse 2, again, was part of the psalm that keeps getting quoted with respect to Christ. And so it actually makes very good sense that iconographers would depict this in their iconography. Jordan Peterson then makes the comment, which I thought was an interesting one, how we are so capable of sort of extending our nervous system. John Vervaeke talks about this with respect to the Mars rover, that in many ways we extend our nervous system all the way through time and space, all the way to Mars when we sort of act this thing out. And a stick is sort of the most primordial tool with respect to this. And then Greg Hurwitz sort of sits back and says, you know, it's very interesting how the icon carver's brain works. And I thought this was a and he could really see this because, of course, Hurwitz works with words and Jonathan works with images. So there's a visual aspect to Jonathan. And of course, I think that's a big part of his contributions here, especially phenomenologically, because he does think in images. And so this imagistic symbolic thinking is really helpful in putting these things together. And Hurwitz talks about Indiana Jones needs a prop. And if you're going to create visual icons, well, then you're going to have to introduce props in order to get the point of the story across. Now, and then Jonathan sort of comes back and says, you know, modern fantasy fiction has been particularly good at this. And he thinks about the scene in Lord of the Rings at the bridge at Khazad Dûm, where Gandalf takes his staff and puts it into the ground. Now, we often think of staffs being struck like this, but, and Jonathan says, this is the way I think of it, just bang. And you can sort of get the symbolism of that from heaven to earth down this way. So very, very interesting, very cool. Now, Stephen Blackwood, I love the role that Stephen Blackwood plays. They're usually just kind of all in there getting the interpretation. And Stephen Blackwood sort of sits back and comes up with a little mini homily on the basis of what they've put together. That's sort of the role he plays in there. He's sort of the poet who, you know, in the process of making a sermon, it usually goes like this. I look at the passage. I do some exegetical spade work on the passage. I try to think about how the passage can connect to real life. Well, they're all sort of like a group, and they're all, a bunch of them are doing the exegetical spade work, and then Stephen Blackwood is sort of the preacher who, or the poet, who then sort of gives the little lesson about what they've just talked about. Jordan Peterson talks about Grimm's fairy tales, where there's a lot of them about the water of life. And of course, Moses is deeply connected with water, and Pharaoh is cutting himself off. And in the last episode, we talked about the hardness of his heart. Jonathan Peugeot says what he really needs is more water. And, well, he's cutting himself off from it. Now, one of the things that struck me that I was surprised nobody brought up was the Mosaic Code has a blood is intensely important in the Mosaic Code. Blood can, in a sense, cleanse. So when they do an offering, they sprinkle the altar with blood. And that blood sort of cleanses the altar. Now, that's sort of inverted, of course, because we might think, well, water would cleanse. No, water sometimes cleanses, but blood sometimes cleanses. Blood outside the body has a particular resonance and symbolism in this. And it's often the shedding of blood, and you must not shed blood. For example, if a woman has her period, she has to go outside the camp because this emission of blood is unclean. And so blood has a very interesting role to play in the Mosaic Code. But now, in terms of Egypt, all of the water is turned to blood. It's sort of a deep, it's both a judgment against the nation and in some ways almost the kinds of offering of the nation. And so nobody brought up that point. Headley brings back, and I'm so glad that he did, a point that I had made before, that the emphasis in the story is not get out of oppression. That tends to be how we read it. God relieves them from oppression, and he does. That's sort of the liberationist motif. But that they may worship me. And they note that the word worship, Oz Guinness notes that the word serve, it's basically the same word, that they may go in and serve me. They're serving Pharaoh. It's the word is used in the same place. And basically the argument is that Pharaoh has usurped the Lord, and he is getting the service that the Lord is owed from his own people. And Pharaoh, in that sense, is stealing the Lord's worship. They don't make that point in there, but again, I see that very much as a point in the story. And they talk about freedom. Now, freedom isn't mentioned. Freedom is service to that which is highest. And there's positive and negative freedom. Freedom for and freedom to. Anyone, there's a piano in the back of the sanctuary, anybody can walk in the room and start hitting keys and making sounds. And if there's no rule against hitting keys and making sounds, there's freedom from the prohibition of hitting keys and making sounds. But freedom, too, would be able to sit down at that piano and play a beautiful song. And that sort of shows the two sides of freedom. And what freedom, what worship of the Lord enables us to do is freedom, too. It's sort of like freedom in a marriage. Freedom, too, is a freedom of not from constraint, but of constraint. It's a freedom of discipline. And that discipline bears joys and fruits that freedom from cannot bear. And Jordan Peterson makes the point that freedom is not chaos. And then they get to the funniest verse in the Bible. And again, I I had never seen this until the first time that I had seen it, and then I thought, no, Prager's right. It is hilarious. You know, oh, look, my own men can ruin our own water supply too. This is a theme with the magicians because, of course, in the early plagues, the magicians duplicate it, but what they can't do is undo it. And I think this is also a deep theme in the Bible. Jesus raises the dead. And if I would ask you, which is harder, to make people dead or to raise people from the dead? All of us would say raising people from the dead is the miracle. Killing people happens all the time. And Pharaoh's magicians can only destroy. They can't create. And I think that's a key insight here. And then when Jesus comes, of course, Jesus uses his power. I'm sure many in Judea and the Galilee would love to see Jesus use his power to kill his enemies. That's how almost all of the tyrants of the world use their power. If you take away the power of the sword to compel people through fear, many kingdoms would fall. Jesus is not using that power. Jesus is using the inverse of that power, the power to heal, the power to bring life. And it's interesting that the magicians don't have that power. Greg Hurwitz makes the observation that I think anyone from our culture, when we read the Bible, we usually make. The Bible loves to talk about everything. If you read the book of Genesis carefully, the famine that happens, Joseph's famine, is over all the earth. The flood is over all the earth. All the nations of the world come to Egypt. And now, if I'm being sort of a troll in a Bible study, I'll say, did the Mesoamericans go to Egypt? Did the Chinese go to Egypt? Did the Aboriginals in Australia go to Egypt? And people would say no. Well, then why does it say all? And this is part of learning to read the Bible in terms of learning to read it in terms of the terms that the Bible uses. These are the terms that the Bible uses. Now, very quickly, there's another statement that the people in Egypt were digging wells next to the Nile in order to get water. But this gets into, again, the whole historical correspondence question, which has really dogged the physicalist minds of modern readers. And in fact, if you don't want to have to do too much Google searching to find that many people have sort of constructed a chain of events that could account for the plagues, to give a naturalistic account for the plagues. And it usually begins with this plague as a plague of blood, as an algae bloom. And well, when the algae blooms, the fish die, and then, you know, on and on and on and on and on. And so they sort of have a string of events that could say, well, this isn't, again, look at the modern frame, this isn't a supernatural occurrence. Now, it sort of falls apart when you read the text carefully, because the text actually takes great pains to show, for on one hand, trying to remember which plague it was. Basically, Moses is like, well, are you sick of the flies yet? Well, yes. And your magicians can't seem to do anything about them. Well, no. Okay. Well, tell me which day you'd like them to go, and I'll take care of it. Well, tomorrow. Okay. And of course, then it happens. And so, even though we sort of want to see a naturalistic account of it, the text sort of resists that, because the clear teaching of the text is that the Lord has empowered Moses and the Lord is going to listen to Moses. The Lord has given Moses a degree of agency beneath him. Sort of like if you have a great king and then a steward or a servant of the great king will give power to the servant. And so the great king would say, okay, come to me and sort of help me know when best to do this, even though the great king is directing the whole thing. This sort of brings up this really wonderful conversation with Preston Sprinkle and Tim Mackey. Now, I know that a number of people are sort of like, well, Jonathan Peugeot has reintroduced symbolism into no, these things have been around a long time. The church has always been dealing with symbolism. Sometimes Protestants call it typology. And this is really a wonderful conversation between Preston Sprinkle and Tim Mackey. And there are a number of pieces in this conversation that I found interesting. And I'm just going to play a little one, because part of what happens continually is this question of physical correspondence and the modernist conception of history sort of dogs everything we do here. So part of what Preston Sprinkle does is sort of asks Tim Mackey, you know, what he's Tim Mackey just does a beautiful job of sort of opening up the Hebrew text and all of the things that he's found and a lot of the cutting edge that's happening right now in terms of Jewish scholarship. And it's really a fun thing to listen to, and if you're interested in the Bible. But again, you know, I wouldn't say any of these guys are a public theologian in the way that that Jordan Peterson is right now, but there's a ton of really good biblical stuff to find on the internet, and Tim Mackey gives some of the best stuff.
So that in bringing Israel's story to an inverted success instead of failure, he is simultaneously bringing humanity's story to its success instead of the failure that happened. So it's a remarkable way, just to maybe back up and conclude, it's a remarkable way that the biblical authors, they were part of a literary tradition of how to tell their family history. And well, clearly I think there was literary creativity involved. This echoes back to the point that you raised. It doesn't mean they're making it up wholesale, I don't think.
Okay.
Just in the same way that, you know, my wife and I have retold now for 23 years the story of how we met and dated and got engaged and got married. And if we're at somebody's house for dinner for the first time and they ask us to tell the story, like the way we tell it now is pretty tight. Yeah. And we've got like a 5-minute version, you know, and you've got the half hour.
And it's also the case that depending on the people that they're meeting with, depending on, especially pastorally, let's say if these people, if you're good friends with them and you know that their marriage is struggling, depending on other connections that you have with them, the way you tell the story is going to weave in a much larger world. And probably if you're speaking with other Christians, you might emphasize the Lord's providential care or even sense of humor in terms of putting this marriage together. If you're talking with secular people, you might demote it a little bit, but you're going to actually tailor this to tell it in a particular way.
Our version, and it's become stylized, yeah, mm-hmm. over the years.
Sure.
And we've actually, the way we tell it now is been impacted by the 20 intervening years and experiences that we've had that connect back where we can see the threads, you know?
And all storytelling sort of weaves that history together. And, you know, people sometimes, especially in a sort of strict physical correspondentist way, will sort of look at corners and say, no. But all of those have also their own presuppositions. One of the interesting things is early on they were asking, and this is commonly what happens if Christians pursue more and more advanced degrees. Well, do some of these secular universities want conservative Christians participating? And the anxiety on the part of the secular universities is that the conservative Christians have commitments that are going to curtail what they learn. But there's sort of a false floor in there, or a false arena, because those secular universities also have their own presuppositions that are curtailing what they learn. There is no neutral space. There is no arena-less scientific study. That's sort of the myth of scientific and religious neutrality. It doesn't exist. And so what you try to do is keep an eye on your biases and keep an open mind for the ways that God would like to stretch you. But
and so it very much doesn't mean that we're making it up, the fact that we tell a stylized version. Just the opposite. I was there. But The fact is, because we've meditated on the meaning of the story in light of everything that's happened, we tell it in a much more tight, stylized, you could even say creative way, where we'll turn up the volume on certain details, right? We'll take elements of one day, night, and put it with another, because we know that they are actually connected in terms of their meaning. And I think some process, much more sophisticated, but something like that, is at work in biblical literature, that this is a family history, and what they're passing on to us is not just what happened, but the meaning of what happened. And they want us to see the meaning of what happened through the patterns and links that weave all the parts together. That's a kind of, I hope, a simple way of saying it.
I'm going to ask you a practical question to
And then he goes on. But what, again, if you're interested in biblical studies, this is a great conversation. Of course, Tim Mackey does the Bible Project, and he's got a great podcast, and he does a ton of different stuff. So again, the internet has blessed us with enormous volumes of material on the Bible, but it's very interesting that it's this Canadian psychologist who is doing the stuff that, especially in terms of communicating out in the public world. Tim Mackey, I think, his work is mostly focused towards Christians. And I think mostly Christians consume his material. And it doesn't mean it doesn't have a missional outreach. And I certainly use it, and I've used it in the past to point people to and point my church members to and have them look at the videos that he makes. But Peterson is doing it in a public space and in a public way that actually very much sort of public theology. So again, I'm sort of doing this in sort of bite-sized pieces. And so here with this plague, the plague of blood, which is sort of, and that's typical of the Bible. You look at first things, you look at central things, and you look at last things. And again, that's just all sort of narrative storytelling art. So let me know what you think, and you know, I'll keep plunking away at this. I mean, the whole channel is always sort of a process of discovery, so yeah, let me know what you think. Leave a comment.